think I'll try to wind you up. excuse me, I was told to get up here because you made me a preacher. And I didn't have time to put my teeth back in. I take them out when I eat because I can't eat with my teeth. They don't stay there. So you just have to take them with my teeth. If you don't understand what I say, you just ask me. And I'll tell you what I say. Okay. Which he says, as it has in also all the world. And then he repeats that in verse 23 when he says, if you indeed continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you have heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. Now the fact of the matter is that when we look in the scriptures, we don't see how that could be. I mean, we don't see that the gospel is in all the world. We only know from the historical record that the gospel did go to other places, if those historical records can be believed. We're basing our conviction on the fact that that's what the Lord said they were to do, and that's what Paul said they had done. And when you think about the enormity and the vastness of that task, and I know that some people might think or believe that the gospel has been preached to every creature, and they limit that to the known world, even that is an enormous task. I believe when he says every creature under heaven, if there was a creature somewhere outside of the known world, the gospel went to them. How it went, I don't know. Because the record only tells us how the gospel went to certain areas and certain people at certain times. But what this is telling us, and I want us to remember this, that the gospel has gone to every creature under heaven 2,000 years ago. And that illustrates or highlights something to me, and that is that is not being done now. It's gone to many places, but even in my lifetime, I've read about people who don't have a clue about the gospel at all. And I always ask myself, well, how can that be true? That with all our resources and our ability to move around the world quickly, we have not brought the gospel to every creature. It's not the fault of the teachers or the preachers, although they may be the ones blamed quite often, but it is the fault of the people. It's the Christian's responsibility to preach the gospel everywhere that they are. So I noticed as I began looking a little bit more closely that Jesus begins to tell us some things about this process of propagation. And I like to use look at Luke chapter 24. This is Luke's final record of Jesus, except for the first several verses in the book of Acts. But Jesus is saying to the apostles in Luke chapter 24, verses 46 to 49. Chapter 24, I'll be in the right place. He said to them, "Thus it is written, and thus it was necessary for Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead the third day, and that repentance and remission of sins should be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem." If you turn over quickly to Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, you're going to find basically the same idea being expressed. "You shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be my witnesses," or "witnesses to me in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the uttermost," or "to the ends of the earth." So what he's telling us is that there's a beginning place here, and everything that comes into existence has a beginning place. And the preaching of the gospel has a beginning place, but what's my beginning place? What's your beginning place? In actual fact, it's your Jerusalem. What he's telling us is that we are to be speaking and teaching the truth where we are. That's where they were, and that's where they started. Let me tell you a story about an old brother. He's 91 years old now, and he's still actively preaching. His name is Edward Muchacha. And he came to my house one day and had lunch with us. He was with another brother. And he said to me, he always called me Brother Kendall, or Brother Katie. Kendall was a mouthful for the African people, so he shortened it to Katie, which is okay. He said, I want to go and preach the gospel in my rural home. All Africans have a rural home. I keep telling them, you're much richer than I am, because I only have one house, but you have a rural home and you have a city home, most of them do. Anyway, I said, "Where is this?" And he told me, I said, "It's a place called Dwonsa. By car, it's a 3 or 4 hour drive of some of the worst roads in Zimbabwe." And I said to him, "Okay, whenever you can get away from your work in Bufani, which was north of that, just let me know and I'll work out a plan." So it took about 3 or 4 months. And he let me know. He said, I'm going to go to Dwonsa on such and such a day and talk to the village elders about you being able to come." And that's not unusual, because in Zimbabwe, because of the political situation, you often had to get permission from the chiefs or the village leaders, the village elders, whatever they call them, to actually come into the area. So we made an arrangement. He went on Thursday. And fortunately, I think there was a funeral the next day of a prominent person in the neighborhood. Now, this is his home area. And so he went there. And this is a funeral in Zimbabwe doesn't last for an hour or an hour and a half or 2 hours even. It's all day and all night. And it just goes on and on and on. So he's there, but so were all the village elders of the area. So he wisely went and spoke to some of them and asked them if he could have a meeting with them. And they said yes, so they had a meeting, which resulted in them telling him, "Yes, he can come, and you can come and preach. But you have to go there and preach." And so they pointed to a tree. just so happened, fortunately, to be in the area of a man named Gilbert Sabanda, who was himself a village head. But it was right next to or within sight of a huge Seventh-day Adventist building. This was a predominantly Seventh-day Adventist group or area. So we made an arrangement that we would go there. And when we went the first day, we went on a Saturday. And there were 12 men that came to meet us under the tree. And we spent the whole day talking about what the differences were. They were asking all their questions about what we taught and what we believed and what was the difference. And I'll never forget that I was answering a question at a particular time, and one of the men that was sitting right here in front of me got up and walked off, and I thought, oh, let's just go to the bush and meet him. So, well, about 5 minutes later, the guy that was sitting next to him got up and walked off. And I thought, And I turned and looked, and about 100 to 150 yards away, these two guys were talking under another tree. And I thought, oh, this meeting's coming to an end. Well, they came back after a while, and we went on with the questions and stuff like that. And finally, one of them says, I don't have a question. The first guy that went away said, I don't have a question, but I want to make a comment. And he said, I think what you've been saying, as we understand it, is true. But that's what the Bible is teaching. And I never fell on it. Because I've never had a Seventh-day Adventist so quickly admit that maybe he's wrong. And he said, we've been talking about that. And we pointed to his friend and he said, we think that you're right. And shortly after that, the meeting was over. Well, we told them that we were going to be meeting at 10 o'clock the next morning under the tree, and they were welcome to come. Well, none of those 12 men that I know of ever came back. They may have subsequently to 2013 when we left Zimbabwe. And so I've never been back to that congregation. But the next morning there were two other men, and 18 women. And that's normal in Zimbabwe. All the churches, I don't know any congregation that is predominantly men. They are almost always at least 2/3 to 3/4 women, the rest are men. Well, these 18 ladies came, we sang, we taught, we studied, we answered new questions, and around 1 o'clock or so, we got up and left, and we made an arrangement for them to come back in a month's time, or 2 weeks' time. And so we came back. But that was the beginning of a work that Edward wanted to begin in his home area, because he was really worried about it. Now, he's working somewhere else, and the gospel is being spread somewhere else, but not in my home area. And I thought that, he said to me at the beginning, he said, once we get the congregation established there, we can reach out. And I said to him, no, Edward, we can't reach out until we establish those brethren and then let them reach out. And so what happened is that he was wanting to start where he came from, where his home was, among his own people. And that happened. About a month later, we had with us a baptismal tent, which is just a plastic, heavy plastic square or oblong with a metal frame. And they carry water from the water hole and fill it up, and then we could baptize somebody there. And we baptized 18 people that day, 16 women and 2 men. And one of the women we baptized was Zondiwe Zodwa Sibanda, who was the wife of the headman, who just lived at half a mile from where we were living. And the headman started coming. And within 2 months, the headman, his brother, who was the caretaker of the village, whatever that meant, but a position of authority, and both their wives were Christians. And within 2 months, there were 38 Christians in that area. And this was in spite of the opposition by the Seventh-day Adventists. They weren't quiet. They, right from the beginning, they said, you shouldn't trust those people. They're white and they are of the devil. And so, fortunately for us, some of the women said, well, why don't you just come and listen? And that's it. Some of them did. But that's, to me, that's the thing. You start where you are. So it doesn't matter where you are. That's your Jerusalem. That's where you start. We start with those in the neighborhood. I'm more conscious now. I live in an all-black area, but the congregation is all white because it's been there for 65 or something like that years. And almost all of the members have been white all along. And all my neighbors on the street with me, there's nobody else of any other color except me and my wife and a Spanish family, a Mexican family that lives a door, two doors down from me. Everybody else is black. And although they're friendly enough, they're just not interested. My neighbor has been one time to a Wednesday night Bible class and promised he would be coming back on Sunday, and then he came, and that was 3 or 4 months ago. I've made friends with a crippled man, a legless man across the street, and just recently some people have moved into the new house who I think are African. So I think I've got made an edge. And I think they're African because I saw one of the ladies walking from the local shop one day and she had something on her head. And that's how Africans carry their goods, they carry them on their head. And she was just walking along this thing, whatever it was, a cake or biscuits or whatever, was just balanced on her head. And that's just how they do it. It's actually marvelous, it's a skill that none of our women have, or men, actually. And so it made me more conscious of the need now to begin reaching out to the people in the community. Not just because I think they're African, but because I think they're lost. And that should be the motivation. So I've already started talking to my neighbor over there. I'm going back to this neighbor over there. And I'm going to those people over there. And I'm going to go to the others. So that's my intention. Because I think, in the future, I don't know how long, that most of the white people that are in that congregation will be dead. And that building doesn't need to just go to a denomination. It needs to remain as a place where the gospel is taught. And to do that, myself and the members are going to have to actually get involved in our neighbors, with our neighbors. And I think that's part of what Jesus is saying. You start here, then you go there, then you go there, and to the uttermost parts of the world. And the fact of the matter is that the apostles did not go to the uttermost parts of the world. I know some of them went to other places, but the gospel was not taken to the uttermost parts of the earth or to all the world by them, not themselves personally. That would have been an impossible task that the Lord has given them. But through their teaching, and the teaching of those that they taught, who then taught others, who taught others, which is what the scripture says, that the gospel was taken to every creature under heaven. And I see a couple of examples of that. In Mark chapter 5, and particularly verse 20, but you've got in Mark chapter 5 that Jesus heals a man who of the Gadareans, who was possessed by a devil. And in one apology, Jesus said, no. Go home and tell your people what happened to you. And verse 20 says that he, that's the demon-possessed man, departed and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, that's the area from which he came, all that Jesus had done for him and all marveled. That's the pattern. Yes, he's still following Jesus. He's doing what Jesus did, told him to do. But he's lying to his own people. John chapter 4, the Samaritan woman, the woman at the well. She's another example You remember how Jesus talked with her at the well, and he convinced her that he was the Messiah. And what she wanted and what she needed was salvation. And I've always thought about this passage as Jesus' ignoring or sidestepping the racial issue, because this was a racial issue. She's a Samaritan. She said, "Why are you, a Jew, talking to me, a Samaritan woman?" Well, the Jew didn't like the Samaritans, and the Samaritans didn't like the Jew. And a Jew, a real Jew, wouldn't talk to a Samaritan woman, let alone talk to a Samaritan man, let alone talk to a Samaritan woman. But here he is. And the reason is that this was not an issue with him. He came to save souls. And if I remember, it doesn't matter that I live in a black community and I'm white, and that's of course obvious to everybody, they are souls. And I'm responsible, I believe, for telling them the gospel. I'm not responsible for their response to me. I'm responsible for telling them what the Lord wanted me to tell them. And I think that's a responsibility that every Christian has. But as the record goes on, we see that Paul, the Apostle Paul, went everywhere. He went to Galatia, Cyprus. I mean, the gospel went to Cyprus, Galatia, Macedonia, Greece, and so on. And he took it there to much places. He went to Malta, he went to Rome, he went in Asia, and if he fulfilled his wish to go to Spain, he went to Spain. I remember reading some time ago a history of the church in England, and one of the authors in the 14th century, the 4th century, claims that Nicodemus, I think it was, if I'm not wrong, went to England in AD 37 and was the first person to preach the gospel. Well, whether that's true or not, what it tells us is that there were people, and people believed that there were people who had gone to other places to preach the gospel that the apostles couldn't go to. And that's how the word has been spread. So, that brings me actually to what I wanted to talk about. And I labeled it working in foreign fields. And afterwards I thought, that needs to be corrected. Because although in a sense, wherever you go, it's a foreign field. But that's not what Jesus said. He didn't say go into all the foreign fields. And we use that term foreign fields to mean go to another country. But I say in the sense that when you move from the place where you were born or where you grew up or where you've been living for some years, and you go to another group of people, there are some dynamics and some things that are changed, that are different. And I think those differences need to be realized and appreciated. Otherwise, what's going to happen is you're going to fail. So, my first question is, why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you preaching? Now, I know that Paul wrote to the Philippians about having sincere motives. There were some people who, in chapter 1, he was saying, were preaching to envy and strife and selfish ambition and not sincerely. They were trying to damage his work, and I think that sometimes that is done foolishly. But mainly, why am I going and doing what I'm doing? I noticed when I started looking on for information about answering that question, I came across an unidentified author who said, "Some preachers, though they teach the truth, are more interested in building their own empires than in God's kingdom. Sometimes we minister simply for the approval of others. If that's my motive, if that's why I've gone, I think I better go back. I think I better just stop. Another man, and I don't know if this is H.E. Phillips that was a member of the church or not, but my wife said to me when she read this, she said, H.E. Phillips, wasn't he a preacher? I said, well, I don't know. I didn't identify him as a preacher of the Church of Christ. But this is what he said. Of all men, preachers ought to be without envy, but they are not. Self-love, the lust for power, cultivated by the love of money and professionalism in the pulpit, has seized the life and ability of too many preachers, old and young. And he said that, I don't think it's H.E. Phillips, because he said that in October 31st, 2019. So I think H.E. Phillips, at least the one I'm thinking that might be, has been dead for some time. Another man in July of 2019 said, many professing Christianity are genuinely fearful, nervous, and even ashamed when it comes to evangelism. Another guy said, well, not another guy, Jeremiah said, when the Lord spoke to him, he said to him, I will not make mention of him. I will not make mention of the Lord. And that's the attitude that a lot of Christians have. They don't want to talk about the Lord to other people. I don't know why, except that they're afraid. They're afraid to be rejected. And that's not a reason not to open your mouth and talk to a person about the gospel. They may be afraid that they don't know enough and they can't answer whatever that person might say. There's all kinds of fears. But the more we go through this COVID thing, the more I'm convinced that we need to know that we don't have anything to fear. Our God is more powerful than anything. Our God wants us to do what he wants us to do. And when we do it, he'll provide the protection. He'll provide the means for success.
Amen.
And that's what we need to recognize as not only preachers, but as Christians. So Jeremiah said, that I said to my, I guess he's talking to himself, I will not mention him, nor speak any more in his name. And I think it was Colin that mentioned this verse. But his word was in my heart, like a burning fire, shut up in my bones. I was weary of holding back, and I could not. Is that how you feel? I have to say something. I have to teach what I know, because this fire is going to consume me. That's what he's saying. But is that how I feel? Is that how you feel? Is there a fire in your belly? And if there isn't, I suggest you go get a job at IT or something else. Or you develop a fire in your belly that you want to teach the Word of God. And I hope that that will be what's in your heart. So, how do I make that decision? And some of you guys were talking about that at the table at lunchtime, and I told you that I wasn't going to say anything more because I would be telling you what I was going to say this afternoon. And then maybe I should have just told them and they could have got up and told you. I think some people make a deliberate decision. I go to school, I go to university, or maybe I go down to Florida College, and instead of taking a degree in business or something else like that, I finally realize I do want to preach. So I make the decision, I want to be a preacher, so I take a course in Bible, or whatever the case may be. And I don't have any problem with that, I just don't believe that if you haven't been to Florida College or any other institution that educates you in biblical studies, that you can't preach. Well, Paul did go to an institution that taught you how to follow the Lord and teach his word. So he's not included. But what about Luke? I wonder what university Luke went, and where Mark went, and Peter went, and John went, and Jude. Where did they all go to get this information? Well, the Lord gave it to them, that truth, miraculously. And the Lord's not going to do that to us, but he's going to do it to us through our study of the Word. So I'm not saying don't go to university, don't go to college, don't get an education in the Bible, but be careful when you go to school to get your education in the Bible. Because if you don't go to a place like Florida College where the emphasis is on the truth of the Bible, you're going to get a lot of garbage that you're going to be carrying with you into your preaching life. Then I think, and one of the young fellows was telling about how he got into preaching, and I have labeled that as coincidentally being engaged. But I wanted to make this point about those who determine that they are going to preach. They become the goer, the one who's going to some other place. But that implies that there's a supporter. We all know that if the country goes to war, they've got the soldiers that go, but you've got vastly more people that stay at home and support the war effort. So that what they're doing is efficient and effective and victorious. Well, that's exactly what happens when you go as or supported. I've been supported by Emory Hills for years and years, and I'm thankful not only for their support, but for the encouragement that I got from people like Sewell and the straightening out of my thinking that I got from people like Sewell. And I should tell you that he's right about communication. One thing that I hated about missionary work, with a passion almost, was writing them letters back to the church to tell them what I'm doing. And the reason I hated it, because the nature of the work that I was involved in to begin with was not being successful, at least in my eyes. And what I thought maybe the brethren were expecting, that I would be writing and say, oh, we baptized 25 people this month. And, you know, next month we baptized 30. And that wasn't happening. All I was doing was teaching Bible classes. And that's when I had this epiphany that that's what I was supposed to be doing. And the results would come from the Lord. But they were very patient with me. And they were even very patient with me when I didn't write a letter for 3 months. But I do believe, Saul, that you one time said to me, you need to send us a letter. Or you need to send us a report. And my wife, of course, who was married, who was the daughter of a preacher, although he was not a missionary, he fought all over the south, east and the south, she kept telling me, Patty, you need to write a report. And she just drove me crazy. Have you written a report this month? And the next one, have you written a report? You haven't written a report for 2 months. You've got to get with it, Patty. So eventually, I started getting with it. And I did get more regular, but I still had a hard time. But I finally began to realize, and I talked to you the other day, that I was slowly, well, it took me a while to recognize that this was not just a thorn in the flesh. This was a necessity. This is the way that I communicated with them to let them know that what was being done in their name, although they were not my employee, and I agree with Sewell completely, I'm employed by the law. They just provided the means of my doing the work of the Lord, who's my master, that I needed to communicate with them. So, those supporters are really important. And I'm really saddened by knowing that congregations are hanging on to thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and not using those dollars to support preachers. But I just started 5 minutes ago. You must have sped that clock up. But anyway, I was preaching a congregation one time that had $80,000 in the bank when I went. In 2.5 years, when I left, they had 100,000. it was the most painful thing to get them to spend that money. They had a little building that had been paid for years before. They had insurance on everything in the building. They didn't have to worry about that. They had a very small monthly outlay. They were getting $800 and $900 a week in contribution. And so I went to them one day at a business meeting, and there were only four of us, me and myself. I've had three appeals, one for 300, one for 500, and one for 1500 from brethren in Zimbabwe that have these needs, and I found them. And one guy had the cheek to tell me, which one do you think we should do? And before I could answer, the other guy said, I think we can do all of them. We've got plenty of money. And that's what they eventually did, because I seconded them. But to their credit, that congregation, every time I would write to them and say, listen, there's this need, and my work fund won't cover it, my salary won't cover it, can you help us? And sometimes they'd send me $2,000 or whatever it was that I was asking for, so that we could help brethren with food or clothing or diet or Bibles or songbooks or whatever it was. And when we left, I sat down with the men again. I said, listen, this young guy's only asking for $4,500 a month. He's got two children. He cannot live on what you were paying me. And by that time, they were paying me $3,000 because Emery Hills very wisely had written to me the year before and said, we're going to stop our funds at a certain time and send it to somebody where the gospel is harder to proclaim or whatever. I forget the exact wording. And so I had 3 months, and I told the brethren, I said, I've got a choice. I can either leave right now and go back to Africa, because they already knew I was going the following year, or I could leave this congregation and go to a congregation that can support me with what I need, or you can supply what Henry Hills is dropping. So I left the meeting. I said, well, you guys talk about it on the side. And they came back about 10 minutes later and said, no, we'll give you $2,000 a month. So they did for the rest of the time. But they still had boodles of money. So I said to them, give this guy what he needs. How long will it take you to spend what you've got in reserve if you're not covering his salary by your contribution? It'll take you years. So they did. And they've continued then to be a little bit more generous towards the needs of other people. And so I think of that, my work there, as a failure, because I would preach my heart out about sexual immorality and about some other things, and there was a brother who was sitting there. He didn't participate, but he came every Sunday. He was actually more faithful than some of the members. And next to him was his girlfriend, who he didn't have a right to have because he divorced his wife, because he didn't want any more of this girl. And it didn't matter what I said about sexual immorality, about divorce and remarriage. He always complimented me on myself, but he never did anything about it, and he died in that condition. So I couldn't see any obvious changes, but there were, must have been, because they were beginning more generous. So I don't consider that as a failure, except in that area, but as a success in the area of getting them to be more considerate of other people. So, the other way I think that people get into preaching is just almost by accident. And that was my case. I started my first lesson when I was 16. And I was totally unprepared. In the congregation where I was, we had regular men's training classes. And they would get us to do a sermon outline and preach a short sermon in the training class. But I'd never actually preached in front of people, except those men that were there. And I went out for a meeting with five other men and a friend of mine who was a Christian and who was also 16. And when we got there, after a while, one of the older men came and said, we want you to speak. Well, That's what they expected from white people, that you know something about the scripture so you can teach it. So in this meeting where there were dozens of black preachers and these five white preachers, Robert and I preached, and I don't know what I preached. 25 years later, I went back to that congregation, and an old man came up to me and said, "I know you." He said, "I remember you." I said, "Oh, from where?" He said, "From right here." He said, "I remember what you preached, your first sermon." So I said, "I was really happy." I said, "What did I preach?" He said, "You preached on faith from Hebrews chapter 11. And incidentally, that had become one of my favorite books, Hebrews. So I remember that now. I've never forgotten that, my first sermon was from Hebrews chapter 11. But that started a process in which in the weekends and the months and the years that followed, while I was still at home, I went often with these brethren to different places to preach among the rural churches of Zimbabwe. And eventually, Foy Short said to me, he said, "Paddy, I'm trying to gather you and another man to come and work with me and study with me for 2 years." So it was on-the-job preacher training. So I did that. And I ended up staying another 6 months, 18 months with him before I went home, because I was lonely and there were no girls in Guru that were attractive to me or in the church, although there was a young girl there, Foy Short's daughter, but she was too young. Anyway, she was like my sister. Is that 15 minutes? Thank you. I've got an extension like here's a cut.
That's a pie.
That's a pie. Okay, so, but I should tell you this. When I was 9 years old, we were heathens, actually, in my family. We didn't go to church at all. My mother and father told me later that if they went to church once or twice a year, it was a lot, Christmas or Easter. Never both, either either or. So religion was not a part of our lives up until I was 9 or a little bit older. But when I was 9, my mother took us down, all the children down to South Africa to see her mother, who was ill. And during the course of their conversation, my grandmother was asking about the children. And she was telling them about the Anglican, about the Kalani and Paddy. And my grandmother said, and this is what my mom told me like that. My grandmother said, "Well, what about Paddy?" And my mom's exact words were, "Paddy is a naughty little bugger." Now, I don't know how you use that word bugger, but it was a semi-profound word when I was growing up, and you really weren't supposed to say it as a child, but a parent could say it, which was kind of ironic. But anyway, my grandmother said, "He's going to be a preacher." How did she know that? There were no preachers in our family. There were none. I come from a mixture of Presbyterian, Anglican, and I don't know what else in my ancestry. So, but she may have known something, or she made a mistake. But anyway, that's what I became. And actually, in my family, there are two preachers. My younger brother is preaching among the institutionals, which I don't approve of, and knows that. But anyway. This is a matter of short-term trips. And I think that there's a value in going for 3 or 4 weeks, but not much. And one of my main reasons for thinking that is that when you go, what happens to the people you talk? If you converted somebody, what happens to them? I've known of guys that have gone for a few weeks and they reported 18, 20, 30 baptisms. And then what happens to those people? There's nobody to follow up. But you do have that opportunity. Excuse me, when you immigrate to the country where you're going to preach, or to the place that you're going to preach, you're not going there temporarily. The idea is to go permanently. And the Catholics had it right. When they sent a missionary out to Africa or wherever, that man stayed there for the rest of his life. And the fruit of that is in the number of people in countries that they went to who were Catholics and stayed Catholics irrespective of what they learned later on. And that was the real, that's the real value of missionary work, is going and staying and converting and teaching those people so that they can in turn turn around and teach, and you can go home or you can go somewhere else. But that's, excuse me, sometimes when I talk too much or sing too much, I get a scratch in my throat. It's for years, it's not covered by it. So, my advocate, I'm finished. 1 minute. Okay, in 1 minute I'll tell you the rest of the story. Language. That's what you're going to encounter when you go somewhere else. And it may not be so bad in America, although if you're from the South, they may have trouble with your accent. And if you're from the North, they may have trouble with your accent, just like some of you have your trouble with my accent. But incidentally, I don't have an accent, you do. I speak English. Another one is customs and tradition. And I think this is really important wherever you go, because wherever you go, people have customs and traditions. And they'll be different to yours. But where those customs and traditions do not oppose or impose on what the Lord's customs and traditions are, we ought to honor them and we ought to respect them. My brother-in-law, who's a very smart character, sometimes, I won't mention his name because some of you know him, but I think he's stupid in some areas. And one of the areas he was stupid in is he came to Zimbabwe and we went out into the bush preaching. And this lady came and knelt in front of him to give him his lunch. And he was kind of offended. And he said to me afterwards, he said, "What is this?" I said, "What?" "She's kneeling down in front of me. And I don't like that. We're equal." So I said, "Yes, but that's her custom. That's her way of respecting you." And he noticed also that when the lady came to speak to the one man, that's what she did. She didn't look at the man, she just looked at the ground and she just told him what she wanted, but she was on her knees. And I said to him, "Well, that's the custom, that's how they show respect." And they do, an African person didn't look you in the eye, because to him that was a challenge, he was challenging you. When he shook hands with you, he shook like this, but he held his arm here. And that was to show you that he didn't have something else and then he was going to get you with that. He was not going to attack you. He was a bit ineffective, I guess is the word. So those are things that you finally learn. 25 minutes? So, your customs are not their customs, and your customs are not as important as their customs, but the customs of the Lord are the most important for both. And I can tell you the rest of the story of the question of